Hello, my name is Anne-Marie Gerhart, Director of Communications for the Northern Illinois Conference of the United Methodist Church. Welcome to our Clergy Conversation podcast. On this episode, we welcome Reverend Jacques Conway, Chicago Southern District Superintendent, who was interviewed in the Surviving R. Kelly six-part documentary on Lifetime as a police expert. The series, which first aired in early January, brings to light decades of alleged sexual abuse by the R&B singer and gives voice to the survivors. We also welcome Becky Posey Williams, the Senior Director for Sexual Ethics and Advocacy at the General Commission on the Status and Role of Women, as we look at how the church can be a difference and take a stand against sexual misconduct. Well, thank you both for sitting down with me and talking about this very difficult topic of sexual misconduct, sexual abuse. And Jacques, I wanted to start with you. Now, you were a former Oak Park police sergeant. So tell us a little bit how you first became involved in the investigation of R. Kelly. We should say he was accused of child pornography back in 2002 and later found not guilty in 2008.
Sure. My career with the Oak Park Police Department, like all officers, start off in patrol, and eventually, I was promoted to as an investigator of crimes against juveniles, particularly sex abuse crimes. My involvement in this R. Kelly case was, at the same time, I was a girls basketball coach for Oak Park and River Forest High School, the sophomore team. And in the course of, as the basketball coach, one of my players, I learned, was involved with this R. Kelly case. But even before then, I knew her as one of his dancers, even when she was in grade school. And I knew her parents because they were grew up in Oak Park, and I remember them coming through the high school and getting married and having children. Mm-hmm. So that connection goes way beyond as the police officer, but the coach is really and also related to knowing the family.
So tell us a little bit what led your participation in the Surviving R. Kelly docuseries that was airing on Lifetime.
Sure. Well, as a basketball coach, and I was also working as a police officer, I became aware of this VHS tape that kids were talking about in the school, and I was told that I could get a copy of it on the west side of Chicago, where a lot of the suburban kids would go and buy their marijuana and things that they couldn't get in Oak Park. So I went over there, found someone selling the tape, brought it back to the police station, watched it to my dismayment and to the utter, I can't even say the words of it. It just really bothered me to see this tape with someone I've known since she was born. And then I took that tape to the Cook County State Attorney's office so that we could begin a charge of child pornography and sexual abuse.
And so when you saw 6 years later, in 2008, that he was found not guilty, what was going through your mind?
Well, I actually testified in court. So I knew it was going to be a tough case because all of the witnesses that were subpoenaed, including myself, were hearsay. We weren't there, and the victim and the victim's immediate family were not there. So in my several years of investigating crimes against juveniles, I knew that it's hard to win a case if you don't have victims standing up or their family members in their place standing up saying, this is our child, this is what happened. But we thought we had a good case based on the evidence that was presented. The important thing about the evidence that I was called to testify was that athletes take pictures in their uniforms, and they make little baseball cards out of them. And so she gave me her uniform picture, you know, sign, thank you, coach, et cetera, et cetera. And in that picture, she had a bracelet, a charm, a gold chain with a cross on it. This was the same cross that she wore on that video that happened to be given to her by R. Kelly. So just the fact that it was a cross, she was naked in this cross, you know, being abused by this adult, just can't describe it.
Now, you were the only police officer to give an on-camera interview for the Surviving R. Kelly docuseries. So why did you want to participate?
Well, I was asked to, not only because I was part of the police department, data, but I also was the coach, that I had a unique relationship with the case. But I was just deeply disgusted with the fact that it was like he was found not guilty. It was no, he went out and won Emmy Awards, sang, and all these other things. And this people knew behind the scenes. It was like the king who didn't have clothes, but no one would. They would laugh at him when he walked by. But when he was there, they gave him honor. So everyone knew this man's crimes against children. But yet it was the money that kept him in the limelight. And I knew people personally who would still go to his concerts and basically say, well, hey, I don't have nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to support because I love his music. So I felt this was a great opportunity. I didn't realize how, 20 million people were going to watch it. I was asked, and I would have done it anytime, any day. So I was just glad to, these years later, to get a chance to vent again and feel like mm-hmm. I was able to express myself as I couldn't after the case.
Right. Well, we should say the R&B singer denies all these allegations of sexual misconduct involving women and underage girls. And his attorney says the abuse allegations in the docuseries are false. So, and he's also settled lawsuits involving sexual misconduct allegations. How does that sit with you when you know he's denying all these allegations?
Well, of course, any criminal is going to say I didn't do it. I'm used to the criminals saying they didn't do it to prove it otherwise. But the two things hit me one. Two things. And I'm very straightforward about it. Because he had the money, and also because these girls were minorities. They were Hispanic and African Americans. If there was a girl from Kenilworth or Oak Park or River Forest or some well-to-do family, one Caucasian 15-year-old girl, we would not be sitting here having this conversation. But for my mind and my history dealing with these cases, because they were African-American minors and Hispanic girls, even the jury felt they should have known better. They were very consenting. Whole different ball game if there was a different color there.
Well, Becky, let's bring you into the conversation. Tell us a little bit about your role with the Commission on the Status and Role of Women.
Okay. Well, it's great to have the opportunity to be here and sit with you, Jacques. Thank you so much for your voice and what you stand for in this. I serve as a senior director for sexual ethics and advocacy for the United Methodist Church. That role is a part of the staff with the General Commission on the Status and Role of Women. Specifically, my job is to provide a lot of intentional attention in the way of resources and conversations and consultation to the entire Methodist denomination around our work to prevent sexual misconduct from happening and to respond well when we are aware it has happened within the life of the church. So that's what I do on a day-in and day-out basis. We receive quite a number of calls from people who identify themselves as alleged victims within the church, having believed that they have experienced behaviors that constitute sexual misconduct. And certainly, child sexual abuse is one of the behaviors that falls under the definition of sexual misconduct in the Methodist Church.
And I know you watched the Surviving R. Kelly docuseries, and it raises a lot of questions, but it also rallied the Me Too movement again. Tell us about how these women's stories are helping other victims of sexual abuse, in your opinion.
Well, I like Jacques, have a long history of working in this field. I'm actually licensed as a clinical social worker, and My first job out of graduate school in 1981 was in Child Protective Services as an investigator. So I go way back in that. And I sadly sit here, I suppose, in 2019 and say, once again, we are seeing that every time we make the intentional decision to engage in conversation about this subject, and we certainly did that, the docuseries certainly did that, we experience the rippling effect of that, which is we walk away knowing people want to talk about this. People want to be transparent about the reality of this problem in our society and in our church. And so I would say very simply, every time we talk about this, we are giving ourselves the opportunity to name the reality of sexual misconduct in our church and society. And hopefully, as a result of that, we are moving in a direction of doing a significantly better job of putting together resources that will prevent this from happening, mm-hmm. and putting together resources that will always, not sometimes, but always result in a good response. And well, that certainly includes giving the pastoral and healing resources to survivors that have experienced this. It's not a matter of just someone surrendering credentials and we're through with that case. Mm. But there's another life in this that we as a church have a responsibility to provide resources for as well.
So CASRO has also been working on the Church Tube movement. Tell us a little bit about that. I assume that goes along with what you were saying.
Yes. Well, we are the only agency in the United Methodist Church that receives these calls. So we've been receiving these calls for years and years and years. Certainly what hashtag MeToo, the movement, did for us was increase the number of calls that we received. And those came from laity as well as clergy. And they came from people who were identifying themselves as victims. And they also came from people who said, we have got to talk about this openly within the life of our congregations. And so the first thing that took place in early 2018, actually January of 2018, was the release of a joint statement between CASRO and the Council of Bishops that named this as a problem within the life of our church and also named this as a sin. And the Council of Bishops joined with us in encouraging people to come forward and share their stories. And I choose to believe that in receiving those stories, they'll be heard well. There will be a plan for a very healthy and best practice response that includes all parties named in that complaint, and that healing will begin immediately as a result of how that response is designed.
Well, following the docuseries, the Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox, she is calling on any survivors or witnesses with information about R. Kelly to contact her. So why do you think it's so difficult for victims to come forward and to share their stories and make these allegations?
Well, the simple answer for me in that, when I think about specifically my work with the church, is that so many people do not believe they will be believed. And oftentimes that is because of the difference in the positions of the person who has experienced the abuse and the person who has perpetrated the abuse. Oftentimes, the perpetrator may be in a supervisory role. They may be a beloved minister. And this person, whether they are clergy or lay, really question whether anybody's going to believe them in comparison to this person. And we see, I mean, that I think that may speak to some of the R. Kelly stories as well. I mean, he's extremely successful in his career. And who is going to believe a 15-year-old up against him?
I would add to that there is this intimacy relationships that get in the way of victims truly being victims. In my years as investigative crimes, sexual crimes against minors, I never arrested a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Uncle, stepfather, mm-hmm. coach, teacher, family member, etc. People who had intimate relationships. So on one end, the family is completely embarrassed about this relationship and how that's going to have ramifications. And so many of these cases were kept quiet. And we're going to deal with it inside the house. We're not going to get out. When those cases became public in the sense of police involvement, then there's this rationale. Okay, so when this is over, how are we going to put the family back together?
Mm-hmm.
Can't we just kind of get this thing over with? Can we just, you know, there's mistakes made. And so the victim is victimized again.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of, and in this particular case, in the sense of the R. Kelly case, I was never asked to speak as a minister. That kind of bothered me. That I was asked to speak as a coach, asked to speak as a police officer, but not asked to speak as a minister. They didn't want me to deal with that end of it.
How would your response have been different as a minister?
As a minister, my response would have been that our church has been very much quiet. We have suffered the ramifications of the Catholic Church. I grew up in the Catholic Church. I was sexually propositioned by a priest when I was in the, but man, I bet not have said anything about that because it would have been really bad for me in that environment because there was no protection. And you think about this whole case, these 50 people who testified, who gave, not one of them had a relationship with the church. The church is seen as being outside of the real problem. We're not those who can solve it. We're those who just avoid it. And that bothers me that in all of these 50 people who testified and all the things that happened, the church is silent,
mm-hmm.
completely silent. Mm-hmm. And it speaks to what you just said
mm-hmm.
On that. And that's just unfortunate
mm-hmm.
That we have, one, we have wounded healers in the pulpits, and then we have parishioners
mm-hmm.
who either don't want to deal with it or afraid to talk about
mm-hmm.
that. And so how can we minister to the whole body and soul
mm-hmm.
if there's a wound there that we have no medicine for?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a taboo subject.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, it's, you know, it is, and when you add the layer of it happening within the life of a local ministry setting, by and perpetrated by someone in a leadership position. I mean, we are not taught, and I say that as a lifelong United Methodist layperson, we are not taught to question spiritual leaders. And we go to this place where we feel like we are going to be valued and heard and affirmed for who we are, and this will be a safe place for us. And so when this happens, I mean, quite honestly, my term for it being sexual misconduct, when it happens within the life of the church, I believe it's spiritual violence.
Yes.
I believe violence has been perpetrated in a way spiritually that is a huge problem.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, what tools are available through COSRO that will help United Methodists speak about this issue, to stand up against it?
Yeah. Well, we have just finished our quadrennium training Do No Harm, which was held in San Antonio in October. And it was an intensive train-the-trainer event. And one of our keynote speakers was Dr. Jennifer Fried from the University of Oregon. And for probably close to 15 years, she has completed research around the issue of institutional betrayal. Mm-hmm. And it was a fabulous presentation that she gave, and certainly one of our highest rated in the evaluation, because she simply spoke about what it means to have the courage as an institution to come forward and say, we have zero tolerance for this. And we do a lot of good work. We, the United Methodist Church, do a lot of good work, and we have a lot of other denominations that actually look to us for guidance in how to develop policies, how to develop response teams, how to put together good training around boundaries and what it means to have integrity in ministry. Additionally, we put together last year a hashtag MeToo toolkit that is available free. It can be downloaded off of our GCSRW website or either the umsexualethics.org website. It offers some good information that invites a deeper dialogue among laity as well as clergy. And we've had beautiful stories of how it has been used in candlelight vigils that have been held by city government, and pieces of this toolkit used as part of that candlelight vigil, recognizing survivors of sexual misconduct and various other ways. So.
Jacques, I want to go back to something you talked about earlier. One of the episodes in the R. Kelly series is called Black Girls Matter. What is the message for us?
They have the same amount of, they need the same amount of respect and love and protection that those who are not of that sun-kissed color. And if you look at, I mean, you look at what happens in Nigeria. Schools are raided regularly. Mm-hmm. These young babies are taken out of their classrooms and taken away from their families and held. And we hear it, and it's like, oh, wow, it's too bad. The sex trafficking thing we have that goes around our country, and we just take the faces and the names away, and we just look at them as victims. But there's the victim has a name, mm-hmm. and has a soul, and has a future. And we have to be true to what God has placed us here to do, is to be our brothers and sisters' keepers. Mm-hmm. And we can't do that isolated. And I hear people saying, all lives matters. Well, then, damn it, make sure that all lives matters then.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Let's not have this conversation, because we have proof positive that we live in a life where all lives matters. But when all lives don't matter, then we have to say that these people also matter, the black lives and the women and black girls. We have to specify that, because that all doesn't mean all.
You know, one of the things that I encourage all United Methodists to do, and I actually challenged all the bishops to do this when I had the opportunity to speak at the Council of Bishops meeting last year. Look at our social principles. Under paragraph 161, we very clearly say as United Methodists, and have for years, we reject the erroneous notion that one gender is superior to another. We say, as United Methodists, sexual assault is always wrong. It doesn't matter what the circumstances sure. are. It is always wrong. We say, as United Methodists, sexual misconduct must be understood as an exploitation of a power
yes.
relationship. And so how many people sitting in the pews, how many people on staff are regularly visiting these statements that are our core foundational beliefs that shape us as United Methodists? How are we making those statements a priority in our faith communities?
We're not.
I can tell you it's 2019, and in every situation when someone calls in and wants to talk about what they've experienced, a standard question I ask is, were you aware that the Methodist Church has policy around the chargeable offense of sexual misconduct, how to recognize it, and how to report it? Were you aware of that? Unanimously, the answer to that is no.
It's hard to do that in 45 minutes because you got to get the songs in, you got to do the sermonette, you got to do the collection. It's like a commercial. We can only get so much in.
Right.
And so those things that are important are left aside because that's not worship. Yeah.
And so how does this conversation become an agenda item on a charge conference?
Yeah.
Hmm. How do we weave this conversation into the very fabric of us as United Methodists so that it is not a conversation we have in reaction to something happen, but from a prevention standpoint?
Sure. There was a time when the United Methodist Church was known as advocates.
Absolutely.
They were known. I mean, we have our agencies, and those who are affiliated with us know. I'm talking about communities and governments.
Absolutely.
Knew that the Methodists were going to be at the forefront of issues.
Yes.
Can we say that today?
So, Becky, if someone is the victim of sexual misconduct or abuse, who should they call?
Well, they certainly can call our office if they have questions about what their next step should be. We offer a 1-800 number, and that number is 800-523-8390. That's a confidential toll-free number available to anyone. If they do not have questions about what to do next, that information needs to be shared with district superintendent or the bishop's office.
When you watch the women's pain and suffering through this docu-series, what is our takeaway?
That now we've watched the program, it's time to act. We have to reach out and be the church, the community, the brothers and sisters who come to offer help and resources and love to the least among us. The victims will be victims weeks, months, years after the program is over and this whole thing is gone. But we as a church will have to still be here to minister to those who need us. And we have to do that. We can't wait for who? Who are we waiting for? The next great pastor? The next great bishop? We're the church.
Mm-hmm.
All of us who walk through the doors of our places of worship make up the church.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not one person who can make that difference. It's those of us who say, enough's enough. Yeah.
Well, thank you both for sharing your insight and talking about this difficult topic.
Thank you.